It is Saturday, October 17th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. Hello, I'm Bonnie Primsch, and with me in the studio is Brian Young, CG artist, iOS developer, and lifelong tinkerer.
Oh, hey, Bonnie.
Brian, how can you know that? You haven't lived your whole life long yet.
I've lived all of my life that I've lived.
Well, that is a point. And Niall Troxell, software engineer, maker, and family man.
That's right.
I have no questions.
Okay.
Well, there's an interesting number of things to talk about today. And why don't we start with something that I thought had gone away, but apparently has not died, zombie cookies.
Zombies never die.
So what's going on with Verizon and zombie cookies?
Okay, let's go over what a cookie is really quick.
Yeah, let's start with just a cookie.
A web cookie.
Is it delicious?
Yes. The web cookie, I believe, is delicious because I'm a web developer and they're very useful.
Okay.
And they're basically the concept of every time you visit a website online, you could be anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go to your email account, for example, Gmail or Yahoo Mail or something like that, when you log in and give your credentials, I will take and make a special ID and give it to you. And I say, if you come back, give me that again and I'll know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next time you visit the website, your Gmail, whatever, you hand me the cookie, only me, and I see it and go, oh, that's that unique thing I gave to Bonnie.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Bonnie's email. So it's a way of allowing you to identify yourself to my server.
But
so it's very useful. It's called a cookie.
Yes. And so in the mid-90s,
yeah.
I had friends who were sort of bending over backwards to not have cookies be something that their computer had to interact with.
Yeah, because they're so scary.
Yeah, why?
Well, yeah, my father-in-law does the same thing. He had those little tools that would make sure that no cookies would be saved. And of course, all the browsers added different options on clearing cookies.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, they added them smarter later where you can clear them by just the last few minutes, last few hours. You can actually be more selective. But all it's doing is just identifying you to the site. And most of the time, that's what you want. But
sometimes
there are cases where people get worried about privacy.
Right.
The side effect is this, and this is why people are concerned about cookies. If you visit your Gmail and I give you an ad, and Brian's the ad company, he's another website, your browser loads an image, and that image comes from Brian, and he sets a cookie on you. Now, you've actually visited my site. You don't even know about Brian,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then you go over to Zombocom, and you look at that site for a while, and let's say they put an ad up, though Zombocom never puts ads up because it's too awesome.
At Zombo.com?
Zombo.com. Mm. And at Zombo.com, they also load an image of an ad from Brian. Now, Brian knows you read your email and also knows you went to the awesome site Zombo.com,
mm-hmm.
and now he knows what you're doing. That's tracking, and that's the side effect of cookies.
Okay. Well, it makes sense because you can do anything at Zombo.com.
That's right. So that's what a cookie is for initially, and because of the side effect of being mm-hmm. able to be tracked through them, they became kind of the sensitive thing. Now, one thing you can do is you can go into incognito mode in your browser, which just turns off all cookies. Forget about using like Gmail or something.
Then
Well, wait a second. Something that was done in Safari, and I think Firefox has followed the lead on. Have all of them followed the lead on? What you were describing there is what we call third-party cookies. So if I go to
I wasn't going to get into that detail, but that's true.
Oh, okay. Okay. Anyway, so that specific scenario, there's an automatic way to have it turned off. In fact, I think that's the default in most browsers these days.
That's correct. Now, additionally, the browser, you can go to privacy mode or whatever. When you do that, you're basically telling the browser, don't save cookies. And then you can kind of visit all the different sites. You'll never get cookies. They'll never really know who you are, except for those IP addresses too, but we won't get into that. Verizon a while ago actually thought, you know, it would be really cool if we could sell our users' information on where they're going to advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did is they're a company that handles bandwidth. So what they did is that if you are a Verizon customer, your browser's even in incognito mode. It's not sending cookies, not receiving cookies, knows nothing about cookies. It goes through the Verizon site, the Verizon network, and Verizon goes, ooh, there's Bonnie. Bonnie's this number.
Mm-hmm.
And they append this track ID to your request.
I've been tagged.
Then you visit my site and I can read that number that Verizon put on there. You don't even know it's there. And you can't delete it and it's permanent.
I've been tagged in my sleep.
And it acts kind of like a cookie, and that's why they call it a zombie cookie. But it's not really a cookie because the browser has nothing to do with it. It's a tracking system Verizon put into place.
And is there a difference between zombie cookies and super cookies? We've talked about super cookies before.
Super cookies are slightly different, and that is that there's ways to set cookies like I described with Brian in the middle and Zombocom and me and you. Mm-hmm. There's ways to do that that's a little more tricky, and you can do kind of detection mechanisms where you kind of reinsert a cookie. Those are different, but zombie cookie, this idea that Verizon's doing, is really much more like you can't control it at all. Now, there is something you can do, and that is you can do what's called use a VPN or virtual private network. Mm-hmm. And what that does is that connects you encryptedly through Verizon. So Verizon only sees an encrypted tunnel.
Because it is true that they are not tagging encrypted data.
That's
they
right.
Can't.
They can't get into encrypted data. Unless, of course, they were able to put a certificate on your phone, which maybe in the future they would. Mm-hmm. In any case, Verizon is now trying to really sell this service. But the cool thing is...
To whom?
They're trying to sync it up with AOL's ad network so that AOL knows exactly who you are, Bonnie, and like
so
what you spend on
AOL
your...
AOL and Verizon get together to make sure that I've got a zombie attached to me.
But the great news is that Verizon is actually allowing customers of Verizon to disable this. So you can turn it off, and this is how you do it. You go to geekspeak.org. No, I'm just kidding. You can. We'll have the information there. But
okay. You,
all you have to do is you have to opt out of the company's RMA, or Relevant Mobile Advertising package, which is basically
wow.
tracking package.
And so where in the agreement is that you have to scroll through before you
really
click agree?
Good thing for shows like this and also for news articles like ProPublica, who wrote about this. And then you can call their 866-211-0874 number and tell them, turn off my RMA for your account. Or you can do it through the app. But in any case, the details are online.
And that's if Verizon is your customer.
Isn't it
also true that AT&T and what's the other one?
There are other companies that are dabbling with this.
Yeah.
T-Mobile and AT&T. But I haven't seen that they're currently
Vodafone,
active at this point.
That's the other one.
Yeah. Yeah. They're definitely different packages like this. Yeah. For Verizon, there's an easy way to opt out. So that's why we're talking about that one.
Okay. So if you're an AT&T customer and you want to know if you have zombie cookies, feel free to contact your AT&T representative and see how long you get to find out.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds like a miserable thing to do.
I just want to say one thing, because we've talked about ad blocking. We've talked about tracking in the past. And one of the things I wanted to say is there's a debate there about how websites get their money, how advertisers help free sites to exist. Mm-hmm. But when a ISP, the company you contract to get on the internet with, starts injecting something into your traffic to tag you, that's just a whole nother level that I really think people should be concerned about.
Well, we're going to talk more about machines that monkey with your information when we come back. This is Geek Speak here on KUSP. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch here with Brian Young and Lyle Troxell, and we're talking about tomfoolery and nonsense and other internet things that are happening, as is our wont here at Geek Speak. Let's talk hardware, or what is going on? So there's something happening with Xerox scanners that my understanding was just sort of like a photograph of whatever document you had in there.
Yeah, do you remember way back when? I remember in elementary school there was a mimeograph.
Yeah.
Yeah, it literally did use a photographic technique to put an image onto the paper. And really badly, too. Really, really distorted.
But
and so
they smell so good, though. But all right, so randomly changing numbers on a scan, I don't understand how that's possible.
So copier technology has come a long way. In fact, Xerox has been at the forefront of course, copier technology, but of computer technology way back to Xerox PARC when the graphical user interface was invented in their laboratories. And Apple, took their part of that. And so what's going on here is actually a pretty old story. This came to light about 2 years ago now. But the reason why I'm bringing it up at this point is because there is a fantastic explanation of it.
Oh.
And this is this English video is a new thing. And this is a story of intrigue and deception and an engineering mindset and learning as you go, and a David and Goliath story.
Oh,
it's
gee.
A corporate departmental myopathy, COIA,
oh,
redemption
gosh.
Story,
wow.
a conspiracy theories wrapped up in this, and politics. And it's about a software bug.
Brian, tell us the story.
So what this is on certain Xerox copiers, and these are the ones that big corporations purchase. They're the price of a small car.
Enterprise level ones.
Yeah. And what was noticed was by a IT guy, he's actually, his name is David Crisis. It's German. I'm sorry if I...
How's it spelled?
C-R-I-S-E-S.
Crisis?
He serves as an IT professional, but his field of study is data science and machine learning. And he was called because the company he was supporting was having problems with their copier because they would scan something and the numbers would change. They specifically had a blueprint that they were using for figuring out the square footage of different areas.
Okay.
And the square footage was different on the scan, on the PDF that they generated from that copier than it was on the actual original document.
And to be clear, the amazing part of the story is they were not using optical character recognition per se. When you scan a document and then you turn it into a text file, that's OCR, optical character recognition, there's always mistakes in that. It's a very common thing.
Yeah, and that just makes sense.
Yeah, so anytime you do that, you got to double check it. Because but this story does not have to do with OCR.
Because OCR is like an interpretation thing.
Well, yeah. So the first thing David did was go to the copier and turn off the OCR feature and try it again. And lo and behold, it was consistently changing the number to a different number.
To a consistently different number?
To a consistently different number.
Yeah.
And so this was baffling. He thought this was an April Fool's joke of some sort. He thought they were playing a trick on him. But the more he looked into it, the more he found it. He would scan other documents of columns and lists of numbers. And the thing about a copy is you don't proofread it. You assume it's going to be the same.
Well, I do. I have to admit I do.
And you won't even see the changes unless there's some context.
Right.
Yeah, because the changes, if you look at this document, the changes are not like there's a pixel moved and it was an error and it happened to be that it matched up perfectly. It's like in one picture, it's a 6, and then in the copy, it's an 8, and it's clearly a very clean photocopied 8. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
No. And he documented it and he started to talk to Xerox about it. And the story goes on for quite a while. And of course,
It in the same font?
No. So once again, has nothing to do with the computer understanding what is there in the sense of reading it, in the sense of turning it into letters that you type on a computer.
Golly.
But what this video that I watched that David explains this whole incredible story, he starts going into compression. And this is really important to understand what happens when you're using images and you try to compress them. Because what the market is that Xerox was trying to serve is that there are people that consume massive amounts of data by scanning them.
Right.
And that data is really expensive to move around the wire. It's really expensive to store. They are very big.
Smaller.
They have a lot of pressure to find smaller and smaller ways to store images.
Okay.
So what I want to go through here, a couple things, is to explain a couple different compressions. So we're used to different file formats. You've heard of JPEG. That's the common compression when you're using a photograph. And you've heard of GIF or GIF.
Or GIF,
let's
as
not
some people
get into that.
Yeah.
And in that case, that GIF does not throw out data other than it reduces it to a certain number of colors.
Uh-huh.
JPEG throws out information, but there's all sorts of artifacts that happen. So if you were to use the GIF, the JPEG format for text, you would see that the text gets really garbled, lots of artifacts in the white area and the black area, and it's just not good at text. So in order to deal with scans and copies of images and text, which the copiers need to handle, they started coming up with other techniques for
another file type.
Well, what it is imagine taking a page and separating out where the images are and separating out where the text is into groups.
Okay.
And so that is a compression format that's called JBIG, where it actually
created a new compression format called JBIG to account for text and pictures.
And this wasn't specifically Xerox, but this is what the data science or image compression scientists have been working on. And it literally recognizes what's an image and what might be text, and it can break it up into smaller and smaller groups. Now, imagine...
Is JBIG what this particular Xerox machine was using?
It was.
Similar to that.
Okay.
But they took it a step further.
Oh.
Now, imagine that same page. It has an image on it. It has columns of text. And you can break it up into the section with the image and the section with the text. Well, text is nothing more than 26 or so different characters repeated. You could go down and try to break up each character into its own separate section. And then you could use pattern recognition software to compare each different section. And if you can find ones that match closely enough, you don't have to store each section. All of a sudden, instead of making a scan that's a complete replica of the original, you're just taking the unique bits, unique visual bits, and storing just those. And then to remake the file, to remake what you thought was the original page, you lay out those little sections in the right places, kind of like an old typesetting machine.
Okay.
But if your pattern recognition software makes a mistake, if it all of a sudden thinks that that six looks more like an eight, you're going to change numbers.
Oh, because it will lay down what matched, and if it matches wrong, it'll lay down a perfect eight. It won't lay down a messed up six. It'll lay down an absolute perfect eight, even though the algorithm slightly made it wrong. It looks perfectly wrong.
Now think about this. Xerox is trying to serve customers that want to have less and less data so they can manage this immense amount of data. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden, you can't trust that data. There's documents like legal documents, tax documents, engineering specs, medical records, and prescriptions.
It would be nice if the numbers worked.
Yeah.
Yeah, really important data. Well, we'll find out what people did once they found out this flaw was happening in the machine when we come back. This is Geek Speak. You're listening to KUSP. And it's Geek Speak here on KUSP. Bonnie Jean here with Lyle and Brian. And Brian, you were just telling us a story about a perfectly legible number that was not the right number that showed up fairly regularly on a scan, on a Xerox machine.
On a Xerox copy. You know, Xerox, you had one job.
This is the thing they're known for, is making copies. Okay, awkwardio to say the least. So what happened? They figured out what this flaw was. It was based on sort of partial pattern recognition gone awry.
Yeah. So how do you figure this out? You start looking at all the characters on there, and you realize that eye, that character eye, has the exact same shape as another character eye. And we all know copies don't, they're not exactly the same. So they started doing analysis about how frequently these different characters are coming up. Mm-hmm. They started comparing different settings in the copier. And of course, as is the nature of corporations to try to protect themselves, mm-hmm. Xerox at first downplayed this. They were slow to respond. It was difficult to...
Classic blunder.
It was difficult for David to get a hold of Xerox. Of course, he's in Germany, mm-hmm. and it took a while to make its way through the corporate structure to get to the American market. But at last, he finally got Xerox's attention, and they agreed that, yes, this was a flaw, and that it's only a flaw when you use one of three compression settings. Now, they have three compression settings: normal, high, and highest. And it does not come with the normal setting by default. When it comes from the factory, I think it's in high or highest. Now, that's not referring to higher compression. That means highest amount
quality
of data.
Oh, highest amount of data.
And highest quality. So when you scan in normal, you're doing the most compression possible. Uh-huh. So Xerox said, yes, this is a bug. This is a problem. But nobody gets their copiers by default with this turned on. It's uh-huh. only if you had it on the normal setting, which... of course, if anybody was going through the settings, what else would they put it to?
I love it. It's the normal setting that's broken.
David has a suggestion. This normal setting that has this propensity to scramble the data and change the numbers, maybe it should be called experimental.
or bunnies typing.
Yeah,
monkey unicorns. Typing.
Oh, dear. So that response seems, I'm going to say this, inadequate.
It turned out to be inadequate. Uh-huh. In fact, you've got to watch this video if this story piques your interest. There's this great story about he wondered why the Xerox vice president was talking to him so long on the phone, only when he finally got off this great discussion with the VP, that they had announced that this flaw on their own terms and kept David tied up for hours while the news got out. Very fascinating corporate stuff.
Wow. But,
so
corporate intrigue.
The way the story wraps itself up, it actually didn't drag on very long. It was a matter of weeks, and eventually they got to the root of it. And it wasn't just the normal mode. It was throughout all of the software, and there was a bug that affected all of the which ones? There's two different models: Work Center and Color Cube models of Xerox copies. And there was many model numbers of these. So
that it covers.
And the bug goes back 8 years.
8 years.
Which at this point is 10 years ago. This bug was introduced into their copier software.
And I wonder what's different in this current reality.
And it was on by default. And
oh my gosh!
I want to tell this story, and David wants to tell the story, so it gets out there. Anybody who works in a large government or large corporate office that uses these things, not only do they have to be patched, and it's very important that they apply the patch that was made almost 2 years ago now. But you can't even trust the archive documents you have in those that period of years.
Wait, so there was no recall, nothing?
Well, I can't say for sure whether there's a recall or not. That was not a part of the story that I wrote.
All you've got to do is patch it, so... No big deal, right?
Yeah,
you just patch it. If you knew that had a problem.
If you knew there's a problem.
So basically, when you're talking about this, I mean, the big reason you'd have the setting of normal to save a lot of data storage is so that you could do giant amounts of scanning and archiving. So now, basically, you're dealing with years and years of doing that, and you can just got to throw it all away.
Yes. And if you're an archiver, what do you do with the source material once you've stored it? When you're a giant corporation trying to store all of this great documentation?
Do you compress it?
You burn it.
Yeah, you don't need the paper anymore. It's just taking up space.
Oh, so they don't have the originals.
An archiver may not.
They have very well modified originals. Randomly. It's so bad. I'm sorry, I'm laughing about this. That's horrible.
It is horrible. Well, all right, so you're referring to a story that was highly entertaining. It was your source material for this. And what?
Well, there's even more to the story.
Oh, there's... Okay. If people are curious to follow along as you're talking, though, can you just cite your source?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Well, first of all, the video, it's not something we could ever play on NPR or over the radio. He is free and loose with his cuss words.
Okay. Well, that sounds entertaining.
Yes.
It's a long URL and hard to get to, so just go to geekspeak.org.
Yes.
Okay. Well, so we're going to link to it there, and people will be able to find it there. Okay. We'll do that. All right. So there's more to the story. He was kept on the phone. They deployed their
What I want to point out is Xerox did own up to this. In fact, they cite him very heavily in figuring out the problem, and they did take responsibility for it. And they do have the problem that being a large corporation that has lots of distributors, they don't actually have a list of all the customers.
Oh, right.
But once again, that's why I wanted to help get this story out. But more than that, they did their job. They made sure that this bug got fixed quickly. And for a
Wait, did they? That sounds different from the story you were telling.
8 years is not quick.
No,
yeah,
no.
I don't
understand. From the point of being discovered, they turned around the patch within a matter of a couple weeks, which for testing and everything else that you have to
with these many
models, I want to give them props for that. When they finally owned up to it, they did what they needed to do.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, how widely have they distributed the fact that this problem exists and the patch exists?
That's a good point. Considering the people that may be severely affected, tax documents or health documents, it is a problem. But I promised that this story included more, including conspiracy theory and politics.
Yeah, what about that?
So remember the birthers. Do you remember the whole debate about Barack Obama's
birth certificate?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so going back to 2002, when Barack Obama releases, I believe this is after he is elected, he releases his full birth certificate in the midst of this constant cry.
Fine, here.
The conspiracy theorists examined that document, and they found artifacts in there that look like bad Photoshop copies of letters from one spot to another, of numbers from one spot to another.
So they found the problem, basically, well, without attributing it to the problem.
They saw the side effect of the encryption algorithm, or the compression algorithm they were using. They saw there's a side effect of that, that things get duplicated on the page to save space. And now the document might have still had the same valid numbers, but if you saw the word, the letter T, and later you saw the exact letter T, that's a little suspicious.
Especially on a copy, because nothing gets copied perfectly.
Right, okay.
So I want to say right here, right now, that conspiracy theorists, I can't blame you if you see that artifact. But honestly, look into the story. It's not because anybody was trying to fool somebody else.
Or is this the conspiracy and Xerox is in on it to save Obama's?
Oh, that's it. Xerox is in on it. Yeah. That's the whole thing. Anyways, my gosh, what a tale.
And I don't tell it nearly as well as David does. So I really recommend taking a look at this video, taking a look at his site, and starting to understand a little bit about how this could possibly happen.
Oh my gosh. Well, just really quickly, I want to talk about something very simple that's going very well, apparently, specifically for the great city of Detroit, which apparently had at least 10,000 problems because they have now been fixed thanks to a simple app that they have been using called, what's it called? Inside Detroit.
So just like an iOS app, like an Apple, like an iPhone app, basically.
Yeah, it's like a phone app. And so then if you see like, pothole, then you can go, hey, Detroit infrastructure, improve Detroit. That's the name of the app.
And so the app's launched by the city and then everybody downloads it and they go, cans on 14th weren't picked up. Click.
Yeah. And wow. The app has been running apparently for about 6 months. And Mayor Mike Duggan's administration has caused more than 10,000 problems to be fixed, specifically because of reports coming from the app.
That's awesome. What kind of problems have been addressed? Like, what kind of things can you report on?
Oh, hey, you guys, this looks like an illegal dump site. Oh, really? Roop, cleaned it up. Pothole. You know, there are about 2,092 potholes that were reported. Those are now gone. Here's a nice one, especially for those of us in California. They shut off running water to 991 abandoned structures.
Oh, that sounds like a good savings.
And nice for Detroit, they removed over 500 abandoned vehicles.
Cool.
And fixed some water main breaks and dealt with some traffic signal stuff.
Hey, city where we live, get on this. This sounds awesome.
I mean, this must be duplicatable.
I mean, Detroit makes sense because it is massive city, right? It's
a big
city.
Well, and that's part of what inspired creating the app is just like it's hard. It's just hard to keep track of everything.
That's cool. Like the citizenship worked on this. So 16,000 people downloaded this. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people participating. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Now, Miles found this on Motor City Muckraker, which is it sounds specifically like a Michigan type site, a Detroit site. So it's possible these things are happening elsewhere. If you know about this app running in other cities, let us know at geeks@geekspeak.org and we'll let your fellow listeners know. It's GeekSpeak here on KUSP. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. Bonnie Jean here with Brian and Lyle. And we're talking about things going well after having heard a very long and sort of arduous, shocking tale about something going very badly for lots and lots of people. We just heard about Detroit doing right by their citizens, and now Volvo's taking a stand toward the greater good.
That's right. Volvo is working on a driverless car. They don't have it on the roads, of course. But one of the things they've claimed recently is that their driverless car from get-go, when people start using it on the roads and it's driving them around, Volvo company will take full responsibility for accidents caused by their car.
Oh.
So this is really, and this is actually similar to what Mercedes has said and also what Google has said with regards to cars. And the reason they're doing this is, first, they're going to be a lot safer.
Yeah.
These robotic cars. And because there's a lot of legislation and problems around that situation, right? If I give you a robotic vehicle and you drive in it and you get in an accident, is it your fault or my fault or some AI fault? And we've joked about that on GeekSpeak a bit, like, well, who gets, you know, if there's a murder in it, what happened?
That's a real thing to sort out.
It's a serious problem you got to figure it out. So the companies are just saying, like, we'll take liability. We'll take liability, which is really cool. And it's going to solve a lot of the paperwork aspects of getting cars on the road. And the reason why I'm so excited about driverless cars has to do with the amount of accidents and amount of deaths in the U.S. and all over the world because people are not very good at what they do.
Yeah.
They think they're better than they are. And robotic cars, theoretically, if you do them right, will be a lot safer than humans behind the wheel.
Yeah, it just seems like sometimes we do really damaging things with machinery.
We really do. We're not very good at this. And it's most of the time it's accidental. Sometimes it's intentional. Mm-hmm. And there is something kind of hard to say, we're going to let go of the car, right? Like, I like driving a car. I have an electric car and I actually enjoy driving it to some degree, right? Yeah. It's fun. But at the same time, from the impact on society and how many people die, I'm willing to trade that fun for less people dying.
Assuming that there's more fun to be had elsewhere, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess you could like go off road or, you know, go some safe place like a track or something. I mean, I used to ride a motorcycle, and then I got in a head on collision and I don't ride a motorcycle no more.
Oh, really?
And the reason is because it was bad and dangerous. I still love motorcycles, but I don't want to die.
You don't want to die on one.
Yeah. Yeah. And motorcycles, of course, are more likely to kill you than cars. But
even than cars.
Cars, not so good.
Yeah.
Well, so wait, you're starting to outline the scenario where in the future, when we have the insurance companies and the car manufacturers pointing out that there are vastly less deaths when you have automatic self-driving cars running around, you're painting a future where eventually it's going to be shunned or downright legislated that people are not allowed to drive. It'll be like you're a driver. That's like secondhand smoke. You're going to kill somebody.
Yeah. You're those jerks lurking around having your sad little cigarette break outside the building.
I was thinking about this a lot today because of another story that's similar. And that is that I don't know how it's going to run out. Are we going to first like make cars that are, you know, make a human driven cars more expensive on the road, like have a tax kind of like we do for petroleum cars versus electric cars.
Yeah. Is there going to be an incentive?
Maybe we'll just say, hey, on freeways, no more human controlled vehicles because it's too dangerous on freeways. Lower speeds is okay. Or maybe there's a max speed for if you're driving your own car. But then again, people at the beginning, driverless cars will be a lot more expensive. Right. And therefore, the rich will benefit from the society change. So it's interesting how we're going to see it play out. I'm assuming what will happen is just over time, people will be more and more enjoying the idea of the car taking care of it. And less people will buy cars. And only a few people will be, you know, be a holdout. I don't know if we'll make it illegal. But I can imagine a state where it'll be like socially irresponsible. I hope so.
Which kind of gets us back to the smoking idea.
Well, I imagine these towns that are ghost towns that are set up in the desert just so that people could feel what it was like to drive back in the day.
So have that feeling. Most people are, in the U.S. at least, are drivers, if you're of age. So have that feeling of like you never get to, or you can't drive a car anymore. The enjoyable idea of not being able to drive a car. You don't have that freedom, right? You've got to tell a computer what to do. It's kind of dictated maybe by a corporation actually owns a vehicle and you're leasing it kind of. So that feeling of not having that empowered thing that you grew up with, you know, maybe your first makeout was a drive-in and that's gone now. And now the car maybe is not the same anymore. Mm-hmm. That feeling is kind of related to this next story. And that is that there's a great article by Michael Pasteri. And it's really just a study about him,
a personal essay
about him no longer having any firearms. Mm-hmm. It's no longer a hobby of him. And as you pointed out, Bonnie, you read this article as well. Mm-hmm. Michael was not a giant avid gun fan, but
right.
he had
a few guns.
Weapons.
He had them because like, oh, that's kind of cool. Like, yeah. He had sort of like geeky reasons for wanting the guns that he had.
That's right.
Say.
And what's neat about this is somebody that's outright saying, look, I started dealing with guns and enjoying guns because they had a great history. Mm-hmm. They're interesting machines. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, you can really figure them out. Mm-hmm. Then I mean, I think the first thing he bought was actually a World War II rifle of some sort.
Yeah, it's a historical
kind And then he kind of started collecting them. And then at some point, he kind of didn't use them very much. So he was not an avid continual fan. Mm-hmm. But from a personal story, he did enjoy the hobby for a while. And he just, after recent events, was like, you know what? There's no zombies, really. The police,
not really.
I'm not really a soldier or a police officer. So it's not like, if I've got a problem, I'm going to call somebody. I'm not using this thing for self-defense. It's locked safely because I don't want to, you know, have anybody find it.
I don't even shoot clays. I don't even use them for sport.
He's basically saying, look, it's not worth it to have it anymore because for society to have guns, it's really dangerous. And so it's from a proclamation of an individual.
It's kind of a symbolic move, really.
It is in the sense that it's not going to change the world, right?
But he's decided to walk the talk.
Well, I mean, with something like guns, it's all about personal responsibility anyway. So mm-hmm. you only get to choose to affect your what you're doing. So he's taking the responsibility in the way that he knows best to do for himself. But it's an interesting article bringing up what is the meaning of guns in his life and how does it apply to everyone else?
Yeah, I guess getting back to the last story, at what point do you give up a thing that you love for the greater good?
That's right. That's a very good question. And I do want to address something that I normally don't talk about, and that is that I do, like, I've always enjoyed guns.
What?
Yeah. And, you know, I don't talk about that on Geek Speak because there is a little bit of a stigma around gun usage. You know, you're either extremely pro-gun and you take them away from my cold, dead hands, or you're kind of like, oh, they're kind of scary things. Where do you fall on it, Bonnie?
I fall more on the scary, like, I think they're scary.
Yeah, you know, I grew up with a father who talked about hunting. I would go over to an uncle's house with a deer hanging up in the carport that they just got back from hunting. There was the grandfather's rifle that my dad mm-hmm. said he would hand down to me one day. And I learned to shoot my first guns in summer camp. Mm-hmm. In fact, when me and my friends were two poor college students that we couldn't play paintball because we couldn't go out and buy the guns or paintball guns ourselves, we turned around and we made our own guns out of PVC pipe and calcium carbide and shot these wads of flour at each other and they made a big boom. But yeah, I mean, I come from a place where guns are pretty normal, but
and creative and social, like you associate with your family and connection with your uncle. Probably the biggest connection with them was a gun, right?
Well, my
so
guess
there's a whole
is that's,
social connection around it,
and that social connection is probably largely behind some of the fierce support for maintaining one's gun collection.
Absolutely,
that many people have.
And it is hard to explain to people that are like, ugh, guns, that there's a, you know, it's a very emotional thing. And it's hard to just go, this part of me and who I am, I'm going to hide. And I mean, growing up in kind of a hippie commune kind of space, mm-hmm. I hid my gun obsession all the time. I was like, no, I don't like him. I don't care. And I see my son doing the same thing. And aww. It's hard because I'm very sure that our society would be safer and easier and better for most people if we didn't have guns at all. And I also enjoy them and like them. I don't actually own them because of that stigma, and also because I have kids as well, and I don't really like the mixing of that. But I have, you know, taught my children how to shoot, you know, like mm-hmm. I mean, at some level. And I just want to say that a big part of this is not having empathy for the other side. And though there are completely people on opposite ends that are really strongly advocating one side or the other, that's not really where society is. I think society is more nuanced than that.
But and they don't speak up. And it's in the space where there's some fuzziness or some allowance for complex points of view that change can happen. I think driverless cars are more likely because we've got a whole generation now who's finding their freedom on FaceTime. They can get in touch with their friends virtually anytime they want. They don't need a car to go see their people. And so that's part of what's going to make driverless cars okay. What is going to make it okay for people not to need to have the gun in their house?
I think it's unfortunately a much deeper problem because, of course, all of our media supports the idea of guns are fun and cool.
And they also support the height of the conflict around it.
That's true.
The drama of my guns, not my guns, that's what's doing it. Well, I imagine you might have something to say about that. You can write us at geeks@geekspeak.org. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Bonnie Jean Frimsch with Lyle Troxell and Brian Young. And GeekSpeak is produced by Lyle Troxell with thanks from our intern Chandler and our Canadian correspondent Greg Merkley. Thank you all for being here for our October 17th, 2015 episode of GeekSpeak.
Nice closing, Bonnie. Do you want to continue this conversation for our podcast listeners or let it go?
Well, do you have more to say about it?
Well, the thing that I find really interesting about this is, okay, politically, it's a huge hot button issue, and we are all familiar with that. But what I wish people would do, besides just empathizing with the other side and understanding them, is I wish people would approach problems more not about what they emotionally feel about it, but more what they can reason about it. So with guns, it's a really tough topic, but there's a lot of great information and great data out there that if you just take a moment to actually try to figure out what the data is, instead of staunchly staying to your point, it could really help everyone.
So you're saying that applying reason to the conflict is a way through it.
That's the idea. But you know, everybody's got their bugaboo. There's not a single geek I know that doesn't have one thing that they're not applying science to. Everybody has something that they're blind to looking at the data on.
Yeah. So my sort of idea for how to get through high conflict things like guns or no guns is to understand what my own emotional response is about for myself, to get curious about that. Why does this matter so much to me? And also to get curious about why your position matters so much to you. Understanding specifically the emotional content behind why you're so positional.
Yeah, I think a big growing thing for my wife was when I started explaining to her what it felt like to have a desire that was not appropriate for the environment that I lived in, right? Mm-hmm. Talking about guns was bad. So all my gun stuff was hidden and shameful and secretive.
And in the closet.
I do not want to use that metaphor for this because it's a completely different thing.
Your guns were literally in a closet, isn't that the case?
Well, I didn't have guns. You know, I would carve a stick that looked like a gun and then I would hide that.
Okay.
Kind of thing.
Oh, right. But the
point was when I explained how I felt growing up feeling that way, uh-huh. she had a different perspective completely on what was going on. And that's why we got the bazooka. No, I'm just kidding.
Woohoo! But go to the Truxell compound.
So the aspect of this that I just wanted I think maybe we could wrap some of this up.
Yeah.
But the thing that is interesting to me is if we did come to this from a rational and emotional side of how can we get society to let go of guns, mm-hmm. I can see a pattern that would potentially work. Let's say there's a 50-year moratorium on guns. Within 50 years, guns will be illegal. So everyone that's currently alive and actually has a vote and really cares about this situation is coming to the end of their life. We grandfather people in.
Yeah.
But at that point, we just stop allowing people to get in.
So it's another generational kind of shift.
It's a generational shift. We actually function as a society generationally to get rid of them. And we do it in a large plan effort so that it's not as an attack on the individual who will actually never lose their handgun, right? Hmm. Until they're dead. Cold dead hands will actually work, right?
Cold dead hands, yeah. Man. All right. So what interested me also about this... the people who have guns have their family identity wrapped up in guns, their sort of social sphere wrapped up in guns. People who have enjoyed that environment where their geeky interest in guns is a-okay feel like they are having imposed upon them this idea of gun control means total ban and you can't play with your toys anymore. And that reminds me of women trying to enter the geek space.
Interesting. So the idea that it's a social norm that women are not involved in the geek space or the game space, for example.
Yeah, finally, we've got our thing, right? This is our clubhouse, no girls.
Huh.
You know what I mean? Like that. Yeah. That makes sense. That I've this is a place where
it's
I can feel
some control.
It's
always been like this,
control.
And I feel safe with it being like this. And if you change that, it's an attack against me and who I am
and my sense of control.
Yeah, it's definitely a control thing in some regards. Yeah. But if you think of it without as much a judgmental word about it, but more about hey, who I am and what I identify is this. And if you modify this, you're attacking who I am.
Well, and let me just clarify that when I say some sense of control. We all need to feel, maybe this is just an American thing, but a sense of control over our own lives.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what makes women want to enter the geek space anyway.
Speaking of control, you might have noticed that today's show is completely different in structure. We did a lot of breaks. Bonnie, why?
Well, we are having a pledge drive at the station that hosts this show, KUSP, a station that I'm very fond of.
Me too.
And I know you have a very personal connection to. And we are encouraging people to support this station. If you were listening to our broadcast, you heard some of those pitches for your support, your financial support between the segments.
All those little segments we did when we did in and out, in and out, in and out. We did a lot of them so that during the live broadcast, they could put in, hey, if you're listening, you should be supporting. So we didn't put all those in because we know podcast listeners are more focused listeners, but we are wanting you to donate. And actually, it's very easy to do so. And so if you go to geekspeak.org, at the top, you'll see support. If you click on that, it's /support. You can see the donation links over to KUSP, mm-hmm. but also a call to action, because now that we're no longer on NPR's podcast network, we actually removed ourselves from NPR to be independent, we have ongoing costs on the show. All of us donate our time, all the equipment's donated, mm-hmm. all that.
And NPR up until now has been kind of sporting us as far as hosting goes.
Yeah, as a podcast listener, you'd listen every once in a while, there'd be an NPR kind of promotion in the front of the show that was added by them. And they take the revenue from those commercial underwriting spots and apply it to a balance to KUSP and kick back some money to KUSP. So now that whole thing's not happening, which means we're incurring costs. We're not adding ads. But if you if you want to support us, just go to that support page. There's one little service there, DigitalOcean, which is where we actually currently spend our money. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, they've got like a referral program. So if you need like hosting services and you went through that link, then I think some amount of money would go back to cover our expenses.
Yeah. Basically, if you go to the support Geek Speak area,
yeah,
all that spelled out. You can read it as many times as you want until you decide what you want to do. But we do hope that you act in some way, either by donating to KUSP, by donating to this podcast specifically, or my favorite, both.
And there's one more if you want to not have money leave your hands. And that is you can go to our site and click on the iTunes link on the right-hand side. That'll open up the iTunes page and you can just promote the show. Just write a review of us. And, you know, if you have some negative feedback or feedback of improving the show, email us directly. We'll work on it. We always read the emails. If you have positive, you're doing great kind of stuff and you want to rate us 5 stars, do that on iTunes.
Yeah, don't feel like you have to shout into the nothingness if you want something to happen. Talk to us directly.
Do we need to be clear about what hosting services are? Because there's lots of people out there who have no idea what we just said.
You know, one of the dangers, like we've been doing Geek Speak for like years on KOSP, and one of the things that's happened is that every week it's 51 minutes? 51 minutes of audio perfectly. This week, totally shorter. So we're running over and having the podcast be longer. But the danger of doing the podcast with an undefined time is we could just keep rambling. Yeah, let's talk about that, Brian. Let's talk about something else.
Yeah. So watch out.
Yeah, but maybe we'll have some great tidbits we wouldn't do otherwise.
We absolutely would, and we could actually swear it, but we won't do that. But I do want to say that if you like this kind of stuff, like we have a different format lately. We've been having longer discussions today. We talked about gun control. That's not really a geeky topic. We're doing that because we're trying to promote the show to be more about who we are and what we like and what we want to talk about.
Well, and we're trying to look at kind of the everyday embedded way that geekiness shows up beyond just kind of the super obvious technology geekydom.
There's a lot of shows out there that talk about technology, but geekdom is so much more.
So you listeners of Geek Speak, a podcast, give us feedback on what you think about this. You can do that via Facebook. You can do that via Twitter. You can do that via email. Facebook actually probably be easier for us because then it can be an open dialogue to some degree and people can comment on each other.
We're GeekSpeak, KUSP on Facebook, isn't it?
I think we're KUSP Geeks.
Okay.
Yeah. But you can do that. Links from all that from geekspeak.org. Really easy.
Do you want to wrap the show up or do you want to go out with a little tip that I was thinking about?
Oh, I thought you were going to say a ditty.
One of the things we do all the time on the show is recommend to go to geekspeak.org to take a look at something that we've been talking about. And I was thinking for the podcast listeners, if depending on what your podcast client is, there are ways to do that while you're walking around, hiking, walking your dog, not so much when you're driving. But one app that Lyle and I use called Overcast has a little button that allows you to just tap on it and it'll actually send that part of the story over to your email, to your messages, or to, I like to use Readability as a service. And it's a great way to just bookmark what you were listening to so you can get back to it again later when you're not walking the dog and you want to actually look it up.
And you can also share it. Like when Ben covers like the great science news story that you're like really want to share,
yeah.
You just on Overcast, you go click share to all my friends. Then people get a link directly to it, which is awesome.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
I know some of the other podcast apps also have some feature or another, but take a look at yours and that might help you out.
Well, guys, thanks for listening to Geek Speak. Do get in touch because, boy, that's even more fun when it's an interactive enterprise. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Bunny.